Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, your host and CEO of Bregman Partners. This podcast is part of my mission to help you get massive traction on the things that matter most. We are fortunate to have with us today Marshall Goldsmith. He is the world's leading executive coach. He's authored many New York Times bestsellers. What Got You Here, Won't Get You There was a fantastic one. I loved it myself. His most recent book is Triggers: Creating Behavior That Lasts, Becoming the Person You Want to Be. I have to say, and I don't say this often, that Triggers as a book was dealing with the same issue that I dealt with in my most recent book, 4 Seconds. And I read Marshall's book with a slight cringe and then a lot of enjoyment because he did what I was trying to do better. And you know, it's hard to admit that as an author who certainly I would like you to go out and buy 4 Seconds. But I think Marshall really did a beautiful job with Triggers, and he addressed many of the issues that I was addressing in a way that, even having written a book about the topic, I then read his book and get a tremendous amount of wisdom from it and a tremendous amount of joy from reading it. So Marshall, thank you, and welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate your nice comments. By the way, I want to give someone else credit, my co-author, Mark Reiter, R-E-I-T-E-R. I've done 3 New York Times bestsellers, What Got You Here, Won't Get You There, Mojo, and Triggers. I didn't write any of those books. He did. They're all my ideas. I think he tapes it, he writes, we go back and forth. He is my agent as well, a fantastic guy, great writer. So I just want to make sure he gets some of the credit for this book.
I love that, and I love that you just said that. And maybe before we jump into the book, I want to jump into this ethic that you have. And it's an ethic that I want to say that I want to call it the ethic of giving it all away. And it's an ethic that you just showed in not giving away all the credit. You're holding some of the credit, but you're offering it out there as well. And I know a lot of people who co-author books in the same way, and I don't hear the same thing from them in the same way that you just shared it. You also give everything away on your website, and you've been open about that. And now you're doing the 15 Coaches Initiative, which is giving away everything that you know to 15 people. So I want you to talk maybe just a moment or two about that as an ethic, because it's both smart and it's good marketing and it's ethical, and I just want to hear a little bit about it.
Well, I went to a program in New York with a woman named Aisha Bursell. I met her because I was the coach of the CEO of Herman Miller, a very large furniture company, and she was a designer of furniture, one of his key stakeholders. I interviewed her. We became buddies probably 20 years ago. So Aisha is a great, great woman, and she did a book called Design the Life That You Love. Well, I go to this program, and she says, as part of the program, who are your heroes? So you write down the names of all your heroes. And my heroes were people like Alan Mulally from Ford and Frances Hesselbein at the Girl Scouts and Peter Drucker and Warren Bennis and Buddha, many interesting people. And then she wrote down, why are they your heroes? And it turned out my heroes were all teachers. And they were all very generous, generous teachers. Then she said, cross out their name and write in your name. And I did that and said, well, why don't I be a more generous teacher? That's when I decided that I'm going to basically adopt 15 people. I'm going to give them everything I know for free for the rest of my life, free lifetime mentoring. They're going to go to 6 to 8 hours of days of training, meet all the CEOs that I know, teach them whatever I know for free. And the only price is when they get older, like I am, they need to do the same thing for 15 other people. Just pay it forward. So that's what came up with this idea. It's very, very positive and exciting. Anyone that would like to apply, just go to my website, www.marshallgoldsmith.com. You'll quickly see how to apply. And so far, I have 8,000 applicants.
It's amazing. And talk a little bit about the ethic of giving it all away, not just from a teacher's perspective, but you know, everything is free on your website. You were talking a little bit before the show about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and an ethic that they have.
Well, I like that idea. Bill Gates, kind of, to me, very inspirational, decided to give all his money away. His children are going to make, I think, $10 million apiece, which sounds like a lot of money compared to his net worth. It's close to nothing. He's given almost everything away. He inspired Warren Buffett to do the same thing, Mark Zuckerberg to do the same thing. I'd like to have the same kind of movement started, only instead of giving away money, people are giving away knowledge, giving away everything you know. And in a way, giving away knowledge is better than giving away money. If I give you all of my knowledge, I haven't lost anything. I still have the knowledge. Now you have it and I have it. So there's no loss involved here. So I'm trying to encourage people like me, thought leaders, to ultimately give away everything they know. All my material you may copy, share, download, duplicate, use in church, charity, nonprofit, modify it, translate it, put your name on it. It doesn't make any difference to me. If it does any good for anybody, do it. We're all going to die anyway. Might as well do a little good here.
So I love that. And I can also hear people who might say, who might have fear, right? So this is coming out of a place of generosity and dare I use this word in a leadership context, love. And yeah. And I also hear people from a perspective, you know, from the copyright perspective, that say, oh, but then I'm, you know, I'm going to lose it, and someone else is going to take my big idea, and they're going to use it, and how do you, what do you say to them? Like, what, because I think you're bringing something very, very important to the conversation, and how do we address that concern that people might have?
Well, again, I'm not here to make value judgments for other people. They can do whatever they want to do. If they want to, you know, keep the stuff to themselves, they can keep the stuff to themselves. There's not immoral, illegal, or unethical. That's fine with me. The only thing is, I've got to just speak from my personal experience. I don't think it's hurt my career a whole lot.
Right.
Doesn't seem to have hurt my career any, and it's nicer. See, every day I get multiple emails from somebody that said, something you gave me helped me have a better life. Every day. What's that worth? What's that worth? You know, you can't put a number on that. Well, to me, you know, what's that worth? It's worth a lot. And, you know, if you believe you have something of value, you can give it to people, give it to people. Why not?
Right. Beautiful. I love it.
And also, if someone wants to hire me, they're going to hire me anyway. Look who my coaching clients are. To be fair, my coaching clients are not going to hire the person that read the book.
Right.
They're going to hire the person that wrote the book.
Right.
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 So the fact that somebody else knows what I know, that's fine. That doesn't threaten me at all. They want to hire me, they're going to hire me. And, you know, they're not going to hire me anyway. That's fine. If I can help somebody else, so much the better.
I love it. I think it's profound. And it's amazing how we can get in the way of that for ourselves. But what you're saying makes a tremendous amount of sense.
Let me tell you a story. Years ago, I was back in Valley Station, Kentucky. I was in charge of something called the March of Dimes Bread Drive. We were there to raise money for kids with birth problems or something. And I was in charge of our school's fundraiser. And the local bakery generously donated loaves of bread. And you're supposed to knock on the door and say, you know, I've got this loaf of bread. If you donate money, we'll give you a loaf of bread. My team should have come in last place. We came in first place in probably the entire state of Kentucky. Why? I had a very different philosophy. We were in the poorest neighborhood. I said, you knock on the door, you give people the bread. Now, they're going to throw the bread away anyway at the end of the day. If they're too poor to pay for a loaf of bread, give them the bread. Don't throw it away. Give them the bread. Then after you give them the bread, you say, the bakery's given us this loaf of bread. If you'd like to give some money, that's fine. And if you don't want to, that's okay. We came in first place.
That's amazing.
Don't try to bribe people with a loaf of bread.
Right.
That's demeaning to people.
Right.
Demeaning. And, you know, basic philosophy here is called give away the bread. My theory is if you're nice to people and you give people things, nice people always pay back. It always comes back somehow. It always comes back. Give away the bread. Don't be greedy and try to bribe people. And, you know, if you go to my website and read this, that's nice, but that enables you to sign up for a special program where I'm going to charge you money later, blah, blah, blah. I try not to do that stuff. Why? Just give away the bread. There's other than what I give away, there's nothing there. It's not like I'm holding something back, right? That's it.
I love it. And it's so counter to the sort of rubric of marketing, internet marketing today, which is you trickle stuff out and you give someone a little bit and then they want more, you make them pay for it a little bit. So, and it's there's something always that has felt wrong about that to me, like just uncomfortable.
It's a trick.
Yeah.
And there's no trick, basically. It's all free.
So this is actually a great way and time to jump into the book Triggers, because I think what you're saying makes total sense, and people may have a sort of gut reaction of fear that we were talking about beforehand related to just giving it all away. And that, in effect, is a trigger, right? That's, in effect, something. So let's actually solve for that a little bit here with your book. You break the book into these three categories, the three parts. And the first is, why don't we become the person we want to be? Why don't we become the person we want to be?
Well, you know, I'm probably, you mentioned you knew Joe Kilty, my former partner, and we did part of this research in the olden days at American Express. In our research, in my training classes, we asked people to get feedback. They pick something important to improve. They talk to their coworkers. They follow up, and we measure, do they get better? Well, you know, the good news is people that do the stuff get better. And I guess the better news, people did nothing, didn't get worse. One of my clients years ago was Johnson & Johnson. They had the privilege of working with their top 2,000 leaders, all the way from Ralph Larson, who was the CEO, down to number 2,000. They all went to my class. They were all asked to pick important behavior to improve, develop a plan, talk to people, follow up, and measure do they get better. 98% of the leaders said, I'm going to do what Marshall told me. 98%. A year later, 70% did something, 30% zero. So I interviewed the people who did nothing and say, why'd you do nothing? Their answer had nothing to do with ethics, values, or integrity. They won an award that year, most ethical company in the world. They're good people. They're smart people. Why did they do nothing? A dream. The dream sounds like this. I'm incredibly busy right now. Given pressures of work and home and new technology that follows me everywhere, I feel about as busy as I ever have. Sometimes I feel overcommitted. I don't tell others this, but every now and again, my life is a little bit out of control. But you know, I'm working on some very unique and special challenges right now. And I think the worst of this is going to be over in about 4 or 5 months. And after that, I'm going to take 2 or 3 weeks and get organized and spend some time with the family. I'm going to begin my new healthy life program. And after that, everything is going to be different and it will not be crazy anymore. Have you ever had a dream that vaguely resembles that dream?
Yes, I have.
How many years?
What's interesting is it's the point that the way I articulate that point is it's the point at which the dessert menu comes. And that's the point at which you say, am I going to have one more dessert or am I going to stop now?
That's it.
And that's that decision point.
Yeah, it's it. And you know, all this stuff, everything I teach is incredibly easy in theory. It's difficult in practice. If you read my book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, you read funny story after funny story after funny story. It's tempting to read the book and think, what a bunch of idiots. How could those people be so stupid? The idiots in the book all have IQs of 150. They're all CEOs of multi-billion-dollar companies. And I'll tell you the same thing. This stuff is real easy to understand. This stuff is hard to do. Very hard.
Well, and you speak to another point, which is that it's very easy to look at other people and say, I can't believe these poor schlubs are doing what they're doing, but then look at ourselves and miss the fact that we're doing exactly the same thing. And you know, I've seen this time and time again, and there was actually some interesting research that I was just in a conversation with Jonah Berger, and he had done some very interesting research, and a friend of his had done some interesting research, but he was talking to his dad, who was a DC lawyer, and his dad was complaining about all these lawyers, all these DC lawyers, they all buy these BMWs.
Right.
And Jonah said to his father, you know, Dad, you're a DC lawyer and you have a BMW.
Right.
And he said, yeah, but mine's blue.
Yeah.
Theirs are silver. Right. Right. And it's this way that we like to see ourselves as different, but in reality, we really fall into exactly the same buckets of the people that we're looking at.
Let me give you a story. I'm at UCLA getting my PhD. I'm, 26, 7 years old. I'm full of myself. I think I'm deep and into higher order meaning and all kinds of nonsense. And I'm babbling for 3 weeks about people in Los Angeles. I'm in this little encounter group class with old Dr. Tannenbaum. 3 weeks I babble on about how screwed up they are because all I want to do is impress others. Finally, after 3 weeks, old Dr. Tannenbaum scratches his beard. He looks at me and goes, Marshall, who are you talking to? I said, I'm talking to the group. He said, who in the group are you talking to? I said, I guess everyone. He said, I don't know if you realize this. Every time you've spoken, you've looked at only one person and seem interested in the opinion of only one person. Who's that person? I thought about it, and I said, you. He said, that's right. Why me? There are 10 other people here. I said, you know, Dr. Tannenbaum, I think a person with your incredible educational background and depth can understand the true significance of what I'm saying about how screwed up it is to try to impress people all the time. So he looks at me, scratches his beard, and goes, you know, Marshall, is there any chance for the last 3 weeks all you've been doing is trying to impress me? Well, I looked at him and said, you know, Dr. Tannenbaum, I'm very disappointed. You have missed the significance of everything I've been saying. He looked at me and goes, no, I think I understand. I look around the room, I see these 10 heads, you know. I hated old Dr. Tannenbaum's guts for 6 months. 6 months later, you know what I said? Thank you, Dr. Tannenbaum. You just taught me a great lesson, sir. Well, it's real easy to see my problems where? In everybody else. Not quite so pleasant to see them where? In a mirror.
So this is a good time to bring up your Buddhist practice, which, as you and I spoke about briefly, you're out of the closet on. You know, you're open about it. And it feels important I find this in your writing. I find this in your speaking. I found it here. Your willingness to look starkly at yourself, at others, with reality, with a clear lens. And to say, I've always respected this actually about you, that you're willing to say things. There was a point in the book, I was actually sharing it with my wife, and I think what you were saying is to someone, you're actually a great leader and a mediocre husband. Or maybe right. It was the other way around. I think it was that. And yeah. and I love that. There's no judgment in it, even. It's a reflection of what you're seeing in a way that is clear and for people to be able to see themselves. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your Buddhist practice and also how you cultivate in yourself the willingness and ability to you know, be that clearer mirror.
Well, there are many schools of Buddhist thought. So when someone says, I'm a Buddhist, that really doesn't tell you very much. Buddha said, only do what I teach if it does work for you. If it doesn't work for you, just don't do it. That, by the way, that sentence is a large part of my coaching. Feed forward, a big part of my coaching, based on that one Buddhist idea. Very Buddhist practice, feed forward. Given the fact that Buddha said, only do what I teach if it works for you, there are myriad interpretations of Buddhism. So the differences in Christians between a Unitarian, a Catholic, and a Southern Baptist are huge. The differences in Buddhists are even bigger. So when I say I'm a Buddhist, what does that mean? To start with, I'm not a religious or metaphysical Buddhist. I'm a philosophical Buddhist. And my school of Buddhism is quite very simple. This is heaven. This is hell. This is nirvana. It's not out there somewhere. It's in here. And you learn to find happiness and peace and meaning now, not next week, not next month, not next year. The great Western disease, I'll be happy when I get the money, status, BMW, condominium. I will be happy when. To me, the essence of Buddhism is, no, you won't. No, you won't. You'll be happy now. Buddha was a young man. His father was rich. He tried to protect him from life. He lived in a bubble. 3 times he was able to sneak outside the castle. What did he learn? You get old, you get sick, and you die. Shit happens. And if you're rich, you get old, you get sick, and you die. You're poor, you get old, you get sick, and you die. That's life, right? And Buddha tried to, originally, his father thought he could be happy by having more. You know what he learned? You can't be happy with more. Then Buddha tried to have less. Starved himself, lived in the woods. That didn't work either. You know what he finally learned? You can't be happy with more, and you can't be happy with less. You can only make peace with what you have. If you've ever meditated, you notice a little voice yammering in the back of your mind. Yip, 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 yip. Little voice never shuts up. The voice only has one message. You will be happier when. You move your butt. You scratch your nose. You cough. You get married. You get a PhD. You become rich. It will be better when. To me, the essence of Buddhism is, no, it won't. No, it won't. There is no when. It's all right now. So anyway, that is kind of my Buddhist school. And in terms of my coaching, a lot of my coaching is make peace with the past. Whatever happened, happened. The hand of cards we've been dealt at any second in time, you can't change the hand. We can't change the past. Make peace. Make peace with what happened. You are where you are. What's done is done. Make peace. Don't dwell in the past and say, all right, here I am right now. Right now. how can I do my best right now to play this hand I've been given? And that's, in life, pretty much all we can do. Play the hand.
It's interesting because on the one hand, it's about being present right now, and it's not about the when. On the other hand, coaching is all about improving ourselves for the future.
Right.
How do you put those two together?
I think you've done it yourself. It all goes down to that moment when the chocolate cake shows up.
Right. Right. You impact the future by impacting the present.
That's it.
Right. You talk in the book about questions, right? You share questions. You talk about questions. First, help us understand the difference between passive questions and active questions.
Well, let me just go through the idea, the whole general concept first. I've been practicing this for years. I'm now going to teach something that will help your listeners get better at almost anything, costs nothing, takes 3 minutes a day. Now, some are probably skeptical. 3 minutes a day, costs nothing, help me get better at almost anything. Sounds too good to be true. Half the people quit in 2 weeks. This is incredibly easy to understand. It's incredibly difficult to do. It's called the daily question process. Every day, I pay a woman named Kate to call me up on the phone. Every day, she listens to me read questions I wrote and provide answers I wrote every day. Somebody asked me, why do you pay a woman to call you on the phone every day just to listen to you read questions you wrote and provide answers you wrote? Don't you know the theory about how to change behavior? I wrote the theory about how to change behavior. That's why I pay the woman to call me every day. I know how hard this is. My name is Marshall Goldsmith. I'm the world's number one ranked leadership thinker. I'm the world's number one ranked executive coach. I pay a woman named Kate to call me on the phone every day. She just listens to me read questions I wrote and provide answers I wrote every day. Why do I do this? My name is Marshall Goldsmith. I am too cowardly to do this by myself. I am too undisciplined to do this by myself. I need help, and it's okay. I need help, and it's okay. Well, once we get over this macho nonsense of we can do everything on our own, which is all egotistical macho nonsense, we all need help, and it's okay. My book triggers. 27 CEOs endorse the book, major CEOs. Why am I so proud? They all step up and say, my name is Jim Kim. I'm the president of the World Bank. I need help, and it's okay. My name is Alan Mulally. I'm the CEO of the year in the United States. I need help. It's okay. My name is Frances Hesselbein. I won the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I need help, and it's okay. To me, it's so positive. So anyway, the daily question process.
And let me break in here for 1 second and say that what's powerful about this is you're not saying, here's a technique that will change your capability to act in the world in a certain way. Once you do it, you'll learn it, and then you're not going to need it anymore. What you're saying is it's actually the technique is the change, that ultimately that this is a tool that you don't work to not need anymore. It is a tool that you need for the rest of your life, and it is the tool that helps you.
Exactly. So get out an Excel spreadsheet, write down a series of questions, represent what's most important in your life, friends, family, direct reports, coworkers, life, health, whatever it is. Every question has to be answered with a yes, no, or number, 7 boxes across, 1 for every day of the week. Fill it out every day. At the end of the week, the spreadsheet will give you a report card. I will make a prediction. That report card at the end of the week may not be quite as beautiful as a corporate values plaque people got stuck up on the walls. You do this every day, you know what you quickly learn? Life is incredibly easy to talk. Life's incredibly difficult to live. Easy to talk, and it's hard to live. Let me give you some of my questions, and your readers don't need to write these down. You can send me an email, marshall@marshallgoldsmith.com. I'll send you all my questions, an article about this. One of my questions every day is, how many times yesterday did you try to prove you were right when it was not worth it? I've almost never got a zero my whole life. Kind of hard for that old professor not to be right all the time. Now, how about you? Do you ever try to be right just a tad too much, once or twice maybe?
Every day. Every day. And it's amazing because what I've realized as I've asked these questions, what I've realized to my own shame and detriment is I will do that even more with people over whom I have rank, which is the most dangerous. So, I mean, my kids, for example, I'll always be trying to prove that I'm right. Half the time, at least, I'm wrong. Yeah. But it's an abuse of power. I mean, I see myself do it all the time.
Right. Well, you know what? Kate, want some free coaching?
Yes, of course.
Take a deep breath. Forgive yourself for all previous sins. Whatever you did, you did. Can't change it anyway. make peace and say, starting now, new me. I don't have to keep doing this. New me. You know, we can all change. Buddhist philosophy, every time I take a breath, it's a new me. You don't have to be that same old you you've always been. We can always change. Another one of my questions, how many angry or destructive comments did you make about people yesterday? We all talk about treating people with respect. Why are we stabbing them in the back? How many minutes did you walk? How many push-ups? How many sit-ups? How much do you weigh? Just questions about life. My friend Jim Moore did this, will tell you it saved his life. One of his questions every day, are you currently updated on your physical exam? First 90 days, he said no every day. After 90 days, he said, this is embarrassing. I got to get the dumb exam or quit asking. He got the dumb exam. Doctor said, you have cancer. He's going to be fine. That was years ago. The doctor also said, had you waited 7 months, you'd be dead. Mm-hmm. He knew he should have gotten an exam. He's not stupid. He was 65 years old. He didn't do it. Hold that mirror in face every day. Hard to hide.
And that's what the questions are. The questions are that mirror in the face that say, you know, how am I doing? And when you say no to that question, have I done my physical, am I up to date with my physical exam? When you say no to it, it actually requires a tremendous amount of courage to keep asking the question and keep saying no. I mean, there's a point at which the discord breaks open, but it's very easy for people to just say, you know what, I'm not going to do it, and I'm going to stop asking these questions.
Exactly. Right. I was teaching at the University of Michigan, and I said, how many of you have ever avoided a physical exam before and told yourself, I'm going to get the exam after I go on that healthy foods diet and begin my exercise program? Half the room raised their hand. Then I looked at this one guy and said, did you trick the doctor with that strategy? He looked at me and goes, I am the doctor.
Well, and I'll you know, a depressing or sad story. When I was a kid, I knew a guy who was in his 40s who was going for his exam, and he was trying to get in shape for his exam the day before his exam, and he got a heart attack.
Yeah.
And because he was pushing himself in a way that was just unrealistic. And that's also a move of not seeing reality for what it is. I'm going to try to trick myself. I'm going to try to trick the doctor. I'm going to try to get in shape in 2 days.
That's it. And by the way, this stuff is hard. It is very, very hard to do. I'm not being modest or humble by saying I have this woman call me every day. I am just very literally do not have the courage to do this by myself. Most people don't. It takes courage, it takes humility, and it takes discipline. This is a very humbling process. You do this every day. And by the way, I have a gift. I don't know if you're aware of this, an incredible gift I'm so impressed with. And I don't know if you share this gift. It's the incredible ability on a daily basis to screw up something. Every day.
I share that gift with you.
Yeah, and amazing. I keep thinking I'm going to slide through a day or two, you know, and not screw something up. And not so much. Pretty much every day I screw something up. And well, if you do this daily question thing every day, guess what? You get to look at it.
Well, and I think that's also the point of the breath that you were sharing, which is take a breath and I'm a new man. But that doesn't mean that I'm not going to have to take a breath in 10 minutes and be a new man again.
That
ultimately, that like the questions, the tool, the practice is to keep taking that breath and keep becoming a new man.
Now, see, what you've just said is kind of the essence of Buddhist philosophy and why this is so difficult for the West. The great Western myth is, somehow I will be happy when I get the money status BMW, I make this achievement, when I read this book, all of a sudden I will achieve this enlightenment. And after that, I will be in this perfect state for eternity and never have to worry about it again. That is the great Western disease. Well, doesn't work that way. Life doesn't work that way. It's day to day, to minute, to second, and we're always starting over. And you're never, quote, getting there. There's not some there that you get and live in this state of eternal happiness. That doesn't happen. That's only happened on, by the way, the great Western art form. You may have seen this one before. There is a person. The person is sad. They spend money. They buy a product and they become happy. It's called a commercial. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those. We are bombarded with this message millions of times. The answer is out there. And once I do that, everything is good forever. Not quite.
And we need a practice to remind ourselves of that, the same way that the commercial world in which we live has a practice of reminding us of how spending money will make us happy.
That's it.
You know, we're constantly bombarded. We don't live, you talk a lot about this in the book, creating an environment, and I've talked about this forever too, the importance of creating an environment that makes it more likely you're going to do the things you want to do and less likely that you're going to do the things you don't want to do.
Exactly.
And one of the things that you're saying here, which I think is so important and why we need the kind of support that you're suggesting, is because by nature of the fact that we live in an environment that's broader than the one that we can sculpt for ourselves, we are constantly bombarded by messages,
right,
that tell us, you could be happier if, you could be happier when, show power, be afraid, trickle marketing to people and make them pay. Like, we've got all of these messages and we need some practice. Meditation is a great practice. Questions are a great practice. An environment that helps support the way we want to be so that we become the people we most want to be, or that not even become, that in this particular moment, we are the people that we want to be.
Exactly. And my greatest learning over the past several years is we greatly overestimate willpower.
Right.
We have this delusion that we have this willpower. So every time I teach a class, I'll say, okay, who needs to be a better listener? Half the room raises their hand. I pick some blustery guy that's clearly a bad listener. And I say, okay, Joe, how many years have you been needing to be a better listener? He'll say like 40 years. So I'll say, raise your right hand and repeat after me. My name is Joe. I need to be a better listener. I've not fixed this by myself in 40 years. Who am I kidding? I'm not going to fix this by myself in the future. I need help, and it's okay. It's okay.
It's the basis of Alcoholics Anonymous, this basis of saying I'm not going to get out of this myself. I'm powerless to get out of this by myself in the way that I've tried in the past.
My friend Alan Mulally, one of the great leaders I've ever met in my life, goes to Ford. Company's losing $17 billion with the B dollars. Top 16 leaders, five priorities each, red, yellow, green. The first meeting, green is I'm on plan, yellow not on plan, but have a strategy, red, I'm lost. Not on plan, no strategy. First meeting, they're losing $17 billion, 80 green. Everything is green. Everyone's on plan for every target. So Alan says, well, let's see. We're losing $17 billion and everyone's on plan. I guess the plan must be to lose at least $17 billion because that's right where we are. Do it again. Finally, Mark Fields steps up and he says, red. That was the moment to change Ford. By the way, the company eventually went from $1 to $18.40. He was the CEO of the year in the United States, number three greatest leader in the world, an incredible guy. Mark Fields says red. Alan stands up and applauds. He says, thank you for having the courage to say red. Then he said, Mark, you're not on plan. Red, and you don't know how to get there. Thank you for having the courage to say this. I'm proud of you. Then he said, Mark, you're lost. You don't know how to get there. You're not on plan. And you know, Mark, I know a lot less than you do. And I'm the CEO of Ford. Now I said, you're red. It's okay. And he said, I know less than you. And that's okay too. Why don't we find somebody that actually knows what they're doing, put together a team and try to solve the problem. Within 10 minutes, the problem was solved.
It's amazing.
Once they got over that macho, egotistical crap, right? By the way, how many CEOs have you ever seen stand up and say, you're lost, it's okay. And by the way, I know less than you, and that's okay too. Not so much.
Not so much.
Hear that a lot out there? I can't say I hear that every day. Not so much. Well, by the way, that's what he says every meeting.
Right. It's very hard to operate from the space, which is a very real space, of I don't know. Of really, you know, I actually make this joke that I gave a TED talk on I don't know.
Yeah.
I know more about not knowing than anybody who, right? But it's a very hard space to stay in. And so it requires a practice because it's an amazing thing to be able to say that every day. I don't know and I need help. I don't know, help.
And the reality is for most of life, we don't know. Now, one of my other coaching clients, J.P. Garnier, CEO of Glaxo, taught me a great lesson. I said, what'd you learn about leadership as a CEO of Glaxo? He said, I learned a hard lesson. My suggestions become orders. Now, if they're smart, they're orders. If they're stupid, they're orders. If I want them to be orders, they're orders. If I don't, they're orders anyway. My suggestions are orders. So I said, what'd you learn from me when I was your coach? He said, you taught me one lesson, help me be a better CEO and have a happier life. I said, what was it? Before I speak, breathe. I asked myself one question. Is it worth it? And I said, as a CEO of this big company, 50% of the time, if I had the discipline to stop and breathe and ask myself, is it worth it? What did I decide? Am I right? Maybe. Is it worth it? No. Back to Alan's case. Mark Fields says red. if Alan would have said, have you thought of this? You know what Mark would have said? Yes, sir.
Right.
And then he would just go do it. Right. Well, worst of all worlds. Number one, it's probably a stupid idea. And number two, he has no commitment to its execution. The CEO told me to tell you this. 95% of all CEOs would say, have you thought of this? Have you tried that? What about this? They just start talking. And the reality is, by talking, if they don't know what they're talking about, they do far more harm than good. Alan Mulally's attitude is this: if I am not the world's expert on this topic, why am I talking? If there's another person who can answer this question far better than me, why am I talking? Why don't you listen to the person who actually knows what they're talking about instead of me? And also, just because I am the CEO of the Ford Motor Company, who made me God this week?
You know, it's funny because we need such deep self-confidence to be able to show up in that space in that way, right? Yeah. I mean, if ultimately our job as leaders is to build independently capable teams, we need so much confidence to not know answers and to be able to stand there and say, I will still lead without knowing the answer to this. And the answer is going to come from you.
And by the way, this is very counterintuitive. Do you think people's respect for Alan Mulally went down when he did that or went up?
I'm guessing that it went up.
Way up.
Right. Right.
By the way, when I stand up in front of classes and say, I pay a woman to call me every day because I'm too cowardly to do this by myself and too undisciplined, do they have less respect for me or more?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely more.
Tell the truth.
You and I, I don't know that you knew this, but we both worked for the same investment bank at some point as consultants. And this particular investment bank, I don't want to say their name, but they, and you may know this research, you may have been the person who did the research, but they asked these incoming MBA managers, what is it that the people who report to you need from you? And what is it that they want? And they said, you know, they want vision, they want direction, they want strength and confidence and all these things. And then they asked the people who reported to them, what is it that you want from the people, from these, you know, managers? And to a T, the number one thing that they wanted was for their managers to ask for help.
Yeah.
It's the number thing that they wanted.
Oh, by the way, my friend Jim Kouzis did a research study, a leadership challenge, Kouzis and Posner. 80,000 people evaluated their boss. One item came in dead last, asked for input about how he or she can improve. We don't ask. Ego. Too much ego.
Marshall, it's such a pleasure to have you with us and to have you share your wisdom with us. The book is Triggers, Creating Behavior That Lasts, Becoming the Person You Want to Be. Marshall Goldsmith, thank you so much for your generosity and for being on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure to talk with you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.